Welcome to Artworks, the weekly podcast from the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. One of the most important public artists in New Orleans was Enrique Alferez, who was born in rural Mexico of indigenous Nahua heritage. His life literally spanned the 20th century, and his distinctive vision helped shape the look of the city for over 70 years. And if you don't know his work, stop listening right now and Google Enrique Alferez and take a look at the breadth and the detail of his art. His figurative sculptures, fountains, architectural friezes, bas-reliefs, and carvings can be found on buildings and streets throughout New Orleans, from City Park to Lakefront Airport, from the Central Business District to Algiers Point. The sculpture was often classical, while incorporating some Art Deco abstractions. And as his subjects, he championed laborers and women, with much of his work representing aspects of his indigenous background. Alferez is the subject of a new biography by poet Katie Bowler Young called Enrique Alferez, Sculptor. Director of Global Relations at the University of North Carolina and a poetry professor at Warren Wilson College, as well as a poet, Katie Bowler Young had unrestricted access to his private papers and his family's holdings. And the result is a thoughtful, comprehensive, and visually rich assessment of Enrique Alferez's life and work. I spoke with Katie Bowler Young in the spring, and I was, of course, curious why a poet would choose to write a biography of Enrique Alferez.
I think of myself first as a poet, and I do see a close relationship between the work that I've done on this biography and my life as a poet. I began looking into the life of Enrique Alferez when I was a college student and was going through a difficult time and saw a work of his, The Fountain of the Four Winds, in a public space. And it was someplace I could return to and find solace. I would take my poetry books and sit down between classes. And little by little, I wondered who had created it. And as I learned more about Alferez, what I came to see was his careful study of the human condition that he represented in the human figure. And I think of that very much as the work of the poet as well, that what we are doing or what I am doing in my poetry is trying to go into the interior, really see what those connections between human emotion and the outer world. And I see that in Alferez's approach to his artwork as well.
Why don't you tell us just a little bit about Enrique Alferez? Because I will own my ignorance of really not knowing his work until I received your book. And then looking through this book, which has incredible photographs, I was blown away.
He left an impressive mark on the visual landscape of New Orleans between 1929 and 1999. Well, let me start at the beginning of his life. He was born in 1903 in Zacatecas, Mexico. He, as a young boy, he was part of a family in which his father was also a sculptor. His father primarily pursued religious art. And from his father, Alferez learned to carve, model, draw, build up, learned about additives that could make clay more durable. And as a youth, in addition to working alongside his family, taking care of crops and working with his father in his studio, he also went to school. And there was an incident at school in which he broke something and thought that he was going to get in trouble at home. And what might have seemed like a youthful solution at the time, he decided to run away. And I have to think that in a different time and place, he might have been gone a few hours and returned home rather safely. But instead, he was swept into the Mexican Revolution. And he was just a boy. He was serving under Pancho Villa. And a general took to him when the general noticed that Alferez would make small statues and carve them and sell them or trade them to soldiers. And so this interest that he saw in Alferez of art prompted him to assign Alferez in what seems to be a rather puzzling manner to a man named Mariano Hernandez Arevalo, who was an artist. And Alferez ended up living with a Revelo for a number of years. He crossed into the United States with a Revelo and a Revelo's family in 1919 and began working in El Paso, worked for a photographer. He also found a job at a place called the Fine Art Shop. And he ended up meeting some of El Paso's leaders, including former mayor Tom Lee Sr. and his son, Tom Lee Jr., who went on to become a prized painter of the U.S. Southwest and an author. And the two became lifelong friends.
Alferez studied with the sculptor Laredo Taft in Chicago. How did he get there? How did they meet?
Sure. There was a life-changing moment in El Paso when Alferez and Lee went to see Laredo Taft, kind of the dean of public sculpture in the United States, give a talk. And Taft would frequently go on tour and talk not just about the craft of sculpture, but also the history of it. And that evening, Alferez sat in the audience and watched Taft on stage modeling a figure, building up in clay a figure of Marie Antoinette, and then turning her into the face of an aged woman. And Alferez said that even 60 years later, when he reflected on it, it was like seeing magic. And after the talk, Alferez and a few of his friends went backstage, and Taft met the boys. And Taft turned to them and said, "Who's the genius here?" And Lee pushed Alferez forward. And I think of that as being kind of an unspooling moment at which the rest of his life began becoming solidified as a sculptor. He, about a year later, went and studied with Taft in his Midway Studios in Chicago. From him, he learned both craft and the technique, as well as the history of sculpture, and also how to work as a professional sculptor. And while he was there, he worked on prized Art Deco buildings in Chicago, and then made his way to New Orleans a few years later.
There are two things before we move to New Orleans I'd like to discuss. And one is the range, his extraordinary range of media. Alferez uses stone. He uses clay. He uses wood. And in one of those prized Art Deco buildings, the Palmolive building, he carved the building's elevator doors. These incredibly detailed carved wooden panels. And he did that in, 1928?
Yes, he worked on that in 1928. And he also contributed to other buildings in Chicago as well, including the building at 333 North Michigan Avenue. He did work across mediums, and he did throughout his career. He worked, as you mentioned, in clay and wood and a variety of mediums, but he also, at other periods of his life, turned to things like furniture making.
Exactly.
And during World War II, ran a leather goods shop in Greenwich Village and turned to producing women's fashion and accessories.
It's as though he would work on whatever he could work on with whatever was around for him to work with.
Yes, I think of him as an inventor. If you were to visit his home in Marilia, where he lived between 1969 and 1999 on and off, the house is an amazing visual adventure of all of the things that he created. So whether it's carvings indoors or a copper tub or a clever little door that he built into the wall to easily pass a phone from one room to another, there are all these signs of how his mind was always inventing.
How did he go to New Orleans? How did he end up there, and what kept him there?
Sure. So in 1929, Alferez, as he told the story, he was headed to Uxmal, to Yucatan, and he was going by way of New Orleans and ran low on funds and stopped to find some work. He did end up working on a church in Algiers, Louisiana for a number of months, before he ended up connecting with a man named Franz Blum. Blum was an archaeologist at Tulane University, and he had been hired to reproduce the nunnery quadrangle at Uxmal for the Century of Progress World's Fair in Chicago that was going to take place in 1933 to 34. Taft might also have sparked some interest on Alferez's part to go to New Orleans. Once he got there, though, he very quickly made a group of friends, fellow artists in the French Quarter, which had been kind of coming to life with a confluence of writers and musicians and visual artists. And he connected to what was called the Arts and Crafts Club, which gave artists a place to connect with one another, to learn, to teach, to exhibit. And it really ended up solidifying personal relationships that he had in the city and gave him a space in which to be appreciated as an artist and to work alongside others. So he did go with Blum to Uxmal for that project and worked on that the reproduction. And I think of it as an early moment in which he really gained some agency as an artist. He was turned to as an expert who ended up making some findings that Blum then wrote about in his research. And their connection endured for about a decade. Alferez went back to New Orleans and ended up working during the WPA on City Park, which is a large, beautiful, expansive green park right there in mid-city in New Orleans. And I think of that as the project that really created an enduring tie for him to the city.
Well, I really would like to talk about the impact he left on the visual landscape of the city. What was his draw to public art?
Alferez learned about public art from Laredo Taft in instructive ways that informed his career, in which Alferez's approach to public art was about creating work that was in dialogue, so to speak, with space, and that was both reflective of an environment as well as a shaper of the environment. I also think there were important financial aspects of it. During the WPA, he was among those who was able to be put to work in pursuing what he thought of as his labor. He considered his art and sculpture just that. That was his word, labor. And he was able to work on a number of projects in City Park, from figures in fountains to benches and details on bridges. And in many ways, really contributed to or created the spirit of the park.
Well, looking at his work through your book, he always seemed to be in collaboration with the sites he designed for. What he did at the airport, and that's where the Fountain of the Four Winds is as well. If you can describe the work he did there, because my God, the majesty of that airport. And when you realize when it was being built, flying is not as commonplace as it is now. It was still this miraculous thing. And you get that by looking at that airport.
You do. It is a majestic airport. And it was fully renovated after Hurricane Katrina. I think of that as one of the pearls that came from a lot of destruction and loss. But as the building was being renovated, it became obvious that the original facade from the 1930s was still underneath a rather austere exterior that had been placed over it during the Cold War. And it was restored to a truly glorious splendor. And the exterior of the building has a couple of bas-reliefs that Alferez created, including a figure over the portico and others that are seen throughout the exterior. The most impressive piece of his at the lakefront airport is the Fountain of the Four Winds. And so there are the four mythical figures that are about 9 feet tall each. They sit at the center of an elliptical basin. And there was a very impressive spray when he would create a fountain. He gave attention to the direction and the flow of the water as an overall part of the composition of that visual landscape. Now, when that airport was built, you're right, flying was not so commonplace. And there were a number of details in the airport that were designed to inspire the traveler. There are murals on the inside, for example, that try to help the visitor experience a sense of, I guess you could say, adventure and peace about flying.
And didn't he carve the frieze above the murals?
Yes. As you walk into the airport and you see a compass that's on the ground of the main floor and you look up and you can see a frieze that encircles the ceiling, and it includes figures that contributed to the life of the airport. So you see laborers and draftsmen and those who both were responsible for the design of the airport as well as its ongoing work. And that kind of approach to his work appears in other places as well. It picks up again in City Park, where he worked on bridges that include figures of people who were working on the park.
Including African-American laborers.
He did. He included African-American laborers. The figures were at work in a variety of ways. They might be using surveying equipment or pushing a wheelbarrow, for example. And these appear along the bridge wall. And when he included the African-American figures, there was a fair degree of blowback in the community. It was a bit controversial, and his response to it was that he wanted to represent those who were working there and who were contributing in meaningful ways to creating this beautiful space that they lacked access to at the time as well. He also said that he thought it was important to be able to represent those who he was working alongside, and he knew them to be talented craftsmen. He also suffered similar social penalties that African Americans did in a variety of ways throughout his life.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because he's an immigrant, he's Mexican, and he's indigenous.
He is all of that. I'd say that the degree to which he was accepted varied across time and place. You know, he lived almost the entire 20th century. Norms changed throughout that period, but he definitely experienced a level of exclusion that when I think about why it was that I was so attracted to his life and to know more about him, it was that I saw, even in the most difficult circumstances that he faced, that he continued to triumph and that he had an expectation of dignity both for himself and for others. And I think that is represented in his art and simply in the way that he lived his life.
Well, he included many women in his work. He included, as we said, African Americans and indigenous people as well.
He did. And one of the aspects of work that he turned to later in his career, as he started producing smaller figurative sculpture, there are aspects of his indigenous Nahua heritage. In one of his iconic works, for example, called Woman in Oapil, that is today in the Botanical Garden at City Park in New Orleans, the figure is featured wearing a huipil, which is a traditional garment that is worn both in routine everyday circumstances as well as in ceremonial circumstances. A woman might, for example, acquire one early in life that she knew would be a burial garment. And these kinds of visual connections are made through a number of series of works that he created, charros or traditional horsemen of the charrería, or the rodeo, which is said to have started in his home state of Zacatecas, and other works as well. But that Woman in Oapil, I think of as iconic for a few reasons in terms of creating that visual connection between his art as it is seen in New Orleans and his home in Mexico. And that's that when it was unveiled in the early 1980s at the New Orleans Museum of Art, it was around the time that he also went back to the city, returned to the city, to work again at the Botanical Garden to conduct a restoration of works that had fallen into disrepair and to contribute new works as well. And I think of it as a kind of special homecoming for him, in seeing that work find a permanent home there in City Park. It is in the collection of the New Orleans Museum of Art and on loan to the Botanical Garden, and it really is a splendid piece.
It's very graceful and at the same time so rooted to the earth because of its shape. And in some ways it relates to, but is quite different from, some of his other work in the park, which seemed to defy gravity, like The Gymnast, a statue of a person just balanced on her hand, or the dolphins who are just spraying along the side of the fountain that just seemed to be in midair. It's remarkable.
He did say that gravity was the enemy of the sculptor.
Oh, he certainly succeeded in conquering it.
I think that was one thing he wanted to conquer, as well as defining human emotion more honestly, by which I think he meant he was interested in being able to delve into the features, to understand the muscles and the movement that are part of the emotions that can cross our faces and then become represented in the figure. When I think about your observation of Woman in a Huipil feeling so rooted to the earth, a lot of that I think is accomplished through her feet and how she is poised on her feet. It's a figure that Alferez revised a number of times, seeking to find just the right tone for the piece, how her hands are positioned, how her head is tilted, how her feet are placed, varies just slightly as he's working toward that ideal form.
Well, another statue that he created much earlier, and please forgive my Spanish, La Soldadera?
Yes, La Soldadera is a figure that he began imagining as early as the 1930s. And the Soldaderas had a very important influence in his life. Again, when he was in the revolution for a relatively brief period, he was cared for in a maternal way by the soldaderas, who were alongside the men, often their husbands, with their families in the war. They would make camp. When soldiers fell, they would sometimes pick up weapons and continue on themselves. And Alferez had a very important connection to them that persisted. And he did ultimately work on that figure again in the 1970s, was cast in the 1980s. And he made an important figurative gesture in that figure. He created the sculpture such that the face of La Soldadera resembles his mother. And it is a figurative gesture. There is no evidence to suggest that his mother served in the Mexican Revolution herself, but that what I think he was drawing a connection to is the strength between maternal care for family and community, as well as the strength of the women who he witnessed during the revolution.
Well, the look on the woman's face is so fierce, and she's looking off to the left as though somebody could be approaching, and she's very much on guard, and she has a child suckling at her breast and a rifle at her back.
Yes, she's one fierce mother.
Whoa, I've never seen anything like it.
She is definitely looking for that threat that could be oncoming, and also protecting her infant in a way that the infant is blissfully unaware of the potential for threat. If you look at that figure, even the way that the infant's feet are positioned, you can see a sense of how relaxed the baby is. And again, I think that that was Alferez creating a gesture to the strength that women have for family and for community and for the care of children who they love and protect.
And that's in New Orleans now?
It is. It is also in the Helles Foundation Enrique Alferez Garden, which was established in 2015 in the Botanical Garden at City Park. It is a beautiful garden that features more than a dozen of his works, some of which were purchased and on loan from the Helles Foundation, which has been a generous supporter of Alferez's legacy. Others were gifts from the community. People whose families had received or purchased artwork by Alferez over the years and then gifted it back to be in a public space.
I want to talk about art in public spaces. I mean, he certainly has work in museums as well and private collections, but I just like you perhaps using Alferez as a jumping off point, what that brings to a community to have art in public spaces.
At its best, I think that public art provides a sense of comfort, reinforces identity and connection to place. When I reflect on my own kind of point of origin for this book and think about the difficult period that I was going through and how I found a sense of security because I had access to the art that was in a public space, because I could sit there freely and admire it without being shooed away. There was no concern about my lingering there for extended periods of time. And it gave me a place that I felt kind of protected from the worldly realities that I otherwise was facing. And it began to spark curiosity. And I think that curiosity is such an important part of inspiring us in terms of just how we live our lives. That's the best that we can get from public art.
One of the many things I find so fascinating about Alferez's work is that on one hand, it's very distinctive, and on the other, most of his work was done in collaboration.
It's one of the interesting parts of sculpture, and of particularly of the sculpture of this size, that as many as 15 or so people might be involved, and it could take many months. And if you look back at some of the architectural details that he created as well, that too was a collaboration with an architect who would have provided him with details or a narrative of what they were looking for. And then Alferez would have submitted drawings. And that too, I think of as a collaborative creative process. My instinct is that that is something that Alferez really enjoyed about sculpture as a form, as a discipline. And he also drew extensively. And I see that as more of what he was doing on his own.
We began this conversation by acknowledging you as a poet. And I want to talk about process, your process for a second, and describe the differences for you in writing poetry and writing this biography.
In thinking about the differences between my approach to poetry and my approach to writing this biography, I can say that one thing that was consistent was my discipline. Time of day that I worked, approach to writing. What was very different was the type of research that needed to be conducted, as well as the extraordinary amount of fact-checking, which of course I also do in my poetry as well. If I am writing about particular birds or environmental landscapes, I will fact-check myself to make sure that I've included the right details of nature. I think that one of the things that I find an interesting connection between my interest in poetry and my interest in Alferez's art and writing biography really is also about the discipline of the visual artist. Thinking about my interest in writing both poetry and then also writing about art, I'm intrigued by the process that artists take when they are creating any form of visual art. So whether they're painting or sculpting or creating pottery or other clay works, I'm intrigued by the attention to detail, how they will spend a certain amount of attention to the detail in one area and then also give attention to the work as a whole. And that too is something that I think of as crucial when you're working as a poet, that you are seeking just the right word to put in just the right place. And in this economy of detail, it needs to be just so.
I wonder if you've learned anything from doing this project that you can bring back to your own work as a poet.
I do think that I'm bringing a lot back into my work as a poet. And I've also, in the last year, branched out to become a fiction writer. And I think the approach to writing a biography gave me a sense of how to approach writing at this scale. And so I am writing a novel at this point that I think will be my first published novel. It takes place over a little over 100 years across a couple of geographies with multiple generations of families in two different places. And I think all of the work that I had to do on Alferez's biography to understand time and place in which he lived, that it wasn't enough to know what he was doing. I needed to understand the world and the communities that he was a part of and moving through. All of that became instructive to me in how I could create an imaginary world of a novel.
And finally, Katie, what would you like a reader from Enrique Alferez's sculpture to take away?
I certainly want a reader to recognize the value and the legacy of his artwork, and also to be able to see how he represented many people in his art, and so many can see themselves in the work that he created. And also, since I have been so inspired by the discipline with which he approached his work, sometimes working 12 hours, 13 hours a day in his studio, I like to think that we also can borrow ideas from him about how we can approach the things we love.
And I think that's a good place to end it. Katie, thank you so much. And thank you for writing this book. And again, I want to emphasize the prose, gorgeous, you're a poet, but the pictures, it is filled with photographs, which I think are so necessary when you're writing a book about an artist.
Thank you. I think the Historic New Orleans Collection did a beautiful job in creating this book and being able to bring not just my words to life, but to really show off the beautiful work that he created during his life.
I would agree. Thank you so much, Katie.
Thank you, Joe.
That was Katie Bowler Young. We were talking about her biography, Enrique Alferez, Sculptor. It's available at independent bookstores. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.